things not actually present. On Fantasy with a tribute to Jorge Luis Borges. A talk given at a meeting of Oregon Literary Arts in January 2005. The unabridged Oxford English Dictionary is a wonderful book. It's not quite Borges's Book of Sand, yet it is inexhaustible. All we have ever said and can ever say is in it, if we can only find it. I think of the OED as my wise aunt. So I went to Auntie with my magnifying glass and said, "Auntie, please tell me about Fantasy, because I want to talk about it, but I am not sure what I am talking about." Fantasy, or Fantasy, P-H-A-N-T-A-S-Y, Auntie replies, clearing her throat, is from the Greek Fantasia, lit, a making visible. And she shows me how fantasy in the late Middle Ages meant the mental apprehension of an object of perception, the mind's act of linking itself to the external world, but later came to mean just the reverse. An hallucination, a false perception, or the habit of deluding oneself. And she tells me that the word fantasy also came to mean the imagination itself. The process, the faculty, or the result of forming mental representations of things not actually present. And again, those representations, those imaginations, can be true ones or false. They can be the insights and foresights that make human life possible, or the delusions and follies that bedevil and endanger our lives. So the word fantasy remains ambiguous, standing between the false, the foolish, the shallows of the mind, and the mind's deep, true connection with the real. Auntie has very little to say about fantasy as a kind of literature, so I have to say it. In the Victorian and modernist periods, writers of fantasy were often apologetic about what they did, offering it as a mere whimsy, a sort of bauble fringing to real literature, or passing it off sneakily, as Lewis Carroll did, as being for children and therefore beneath serious notice. Writers of fantasy are often less modest now that what they do is recognized as literature, or at least as a genre of literature, or at least as a sub-literary genre, or at least as a commercial product. Fantasy has, in fact, become quite a business. There are people who turn out unicorns by the yard. Capitalism flourishes in Elfland. But when one night in Buenos Aires in 1937 three friends sat talking together about fantastic literature, it wasn't yet a business. Even less so one night in a villa in Geneva in 1816, when four friends sat talking together and telling ghost stories. They were Mary Godwin, Percy Shelley, Lord Byron, and Mr. Polidori. And they told awful tales to one another, and Mary was scared. "We will each write a ghost story," cried Byron. So Mary went away and thought about it, and a few nights later she had a nightmare in which a pale student used strange arts and machineries to arouse from unlife the hideous phantasm of a man. And so, alone of the friends, she wrote her ghost story, Frankenstein, a modern Prometheus, which is the first great modern fantasy. There are no ghosts in it, but fantasy, as the OED observes, is more than ghouly mongering, because ghosts haunt one corner of the vast domain of fantastic literature. People familiar with that corner of it call the whole thing ghost stories or horror stories, just as others call it fairyland after the part of it they love best or hate worst, and others call it science fiction, and others call it stuff and nonsense. But the nameless being given life by Frankenstein's or Mary Shelley's arts and machineries is not a ghost, not a fairy. Science fictional he may be, stuff and nonsense he is not. He is a creature of fantasy, archetypal, deathless. Once raised, he will not sleep again, for his pain will not let him sleep. The unanswered moral questions that woke with him will not let him rest in peace. When there began to be money in the fantasy business, plenty of money was made out of him in Hollywood, but even that did not kill him. Very likely his story was mentioned on that night in 1937 in Buenos Aires, when Silvina Ocampo and her friends Jorge Luis Borges and Adolfo Bioy Casares fell to talking. So Casares tells us about fantastic literature, discussing the stories which seemed best to us. And they enjoyed it so much, they collected the stories into a book of fantasy, which exists now in both Spanish and English. It is a wild mishmash, horror story and ghost story and fairy tale and science fiction all together. A piece we might think we know almost too well, such as The Cask of Amontillado, regains its strangeness when read among works from the Orient and South America and distant centuries by Kafka, Swedenborg, Cortázar, Akutagawa, Neo-Chiao. The book reflects the taste and curiosity of Borges, who was himself a member of the international tradition of fantasy, which includes Rudyard Kipling and H.G. Wells. Perhaps I should not say tradition, since it has so little recognition in critical circles and is distinguished in college English departments mainly by being ignored. But I believe there is a company of fantasists that Borges belonged to, even as he transcended it, and that he honored, even as he transformed it. By saying fantasy is for children, which, of course, some of it is, and dismissing it as commercial and formulaic, which, of course, some of it is, many academics and most literary critics feel justified in ignoring it all. Yet looking at such writers as Italo Calvino, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and José Saramago, I see our narrative fiction going slowly and massively as a deep current in one direction, and that direction is towards the re-inclusion of fantasy as an essential element of fiction. Or put it this way, fiction, writing it, reading it, is an act of the imagination. Fantasy is, after all, the oldest kind of narrative fiction and the most universal. Fiction offers the best means of understanding people different from oneself, short of experience. Actually, fiction can be lots better than experience because it's a manageable size, it's comprehensible, while experience just steamrollers over you and you understand what happened decades later, if ever. Fiction is terrific at giving factual, psychological, and moral understanding. But realistic fiction is culture-specific. The language, the unspoken assumptions, all the details of ordinary life that are the substance and strength of realistic fiction may be utterly obscure to the reader of another time and place. And reading a realistic story that takes place in another century or another country involves an act of displacement, of translation, which many readers are unable or unwilling to attempt. Fantasy need not have this problem. People tell me they don't read fantasy because it's all just made up, but the material of fantasy is far more permanent, more universal, than the social customs realism deals with. Whether a fantasy is set in the real world or an invented one, its substance is psychic stuff, human constants, imageries we recognize. It seems to be a fact that everybody, everywhere, even if they haven't met one before, recognizes a dragon. Until fairly recently, the societies in and for which realistic fiction was written were limited and homogeneous. The realistic novel could describe such societies. But that limited language is in trouble now. To describe society since the mid-20th century, global, multilingual, infinitely interlinked, we need the global, intuitional language of fantasy. Garcia Marquez wrote his histories of his own nation in the fantastic images of magical realism because it was the only way he could do it. The central moral dilemma of our age and of this very moment now is the use or non-use of annihilating power. This choice was posed most cogently in fictional terms by the purest of fantasists. Tolkien began The Lord of the Rings in 1937 and finished it about 10 years later. During those years, Frodo withheld his hand from the Ring of Power, but the nations did not. So, in so much contemporary fiction, the most revealing and accurate descriptions of our daily life are not shot through with strangeness or displaced in time or set on imaginary worlds or dissolved into the phantasmagoria of drugs or of psychosis, or rise from the mundane suddenly into the visionary and then come out the other side. So the magical realists of South America and their counterparts in India and elsewhere are valued for their accuracy, their truthfulness to the way things are. And so Jorge Luis Borges, who chose to identify himself with a tradition considered marginal, not the mainstream of realism and modernism that dominated literature in his youth and maturity, remains a writer central to our literature. His poems and stories, his images of reflections, libraries, labyrinths, forking paths, his books of tigers, of rivers, of sand, of mysteries, of changes, are everywhere honored because they are beautiful, because they are nourishing, because they fulfill the most ancient, urgent function of words, to form for us mental representations of things not actually present, so that we can form a judgment of what world we live in and where we might be going in it, what we can celebrate, what we must fear.